Chapter 31. Made talk impossible, they bumped over the disjointed cobblestones to the wharf. Seated side by side on a bench of the half-empty boat, they found that they had hardly anything to say to each other, or rather that what they had to say communicated itself best in the blessed silence of their release and their isolation. As the paddle wheels began to turn, and wharves and shipping to recede through the veil of heat, it seemed to Archer that everything in the old familiar world of habit was receding also. He longed to ask Madame Olenska if she did not have the same feeling. The feeling that they were starting on some long voyage from which they might never return. But he was afraid to say it, or anything else, that might disturb the delicate balance of her trust in him. In reality, he had no wish to betray that trust. There had been days and nights when the memory of their kiss had burned and burned on his lips. The day before even, on the drive to Portsmouth, the thought of her had run through him like fire. But now that she was beside him, and they were drifting forth into this unknown world, they seemed to have reached the kind of deeper nearness that a touch may sunder. As the boat left the harbor and turned seaward, a breeze stirred about them, and the bay broke up into long oily undulations, then into ripples tipped with spray. The fog of sultriness still hung over the city, but ahead lay a fresh world of ruffled waters, and distant promontories with lighthouses in the sun. Madame Olenska, leaning back against the boat rail, drank in the coolness between parted lips. As he had wound a long veil about her hat, but it left her face uncovered, and Archer was struck by the tranquil gaiety of her expression. She seemed to take their adventure as a matter of course, and to be neither in fear of unexpected encounters, nor, what was worse, unduly elated by their possibility. In the bare dining room of the inn, which he had hoped they would have to themselves, they found a strident party of innocent-looking young men and women, school teachers on a holiday, the landlord told them, and Archer's heart sank at the idea of having to talk through their noise. "This is hopeless, I'll ask for a private room," he said, and Madame Olenska, without offering any objection, waited while he went in search of it. The room opened on a long wooden veranda, with the sea coming in at the windows. It was bare and cool, with a table covered with a coarse checkered cloth, and adorned by a bottle of pickles, and a blueberry pie under a cage. No more guileless-looking cabinet particularly ever offered its shelter to a clandestine couple. Archer fancied he saw the sense of its reassurance in the faintly amused smile with which Madame Olenska sat down opposite to him. A woman who had run away from her husband and reputedly with another man was likely to have mastered the art of taking things for granted, but something in the quality of her composure took the edge from his irony. By being so quiet, so unsurprised and so simple, as he had managed to brush away the conventions and make him feel that to seek to be alone was the natural thing for two old friends who had so much to say to each other. XXIV. They lunched slowly and meditatively, with mute intervals between rushes of talk, for, the spell once broken, they had much to say, and yet moments when saying became the mere accompaniment to long duologues of silence. Archer kept the talk from his own affairs, not with conscious intention, but because he did not want to miss a word of her history. And leaning on the table, her chin resting on her clasped hands, she talked to him of the year and a half since they had met. As he had grown tired of what people called society, New York was kind, it was almost oppressively hospitable. She should never forget the way in which it had welcomed her back. But after the first flush of novelty, as he had found herself, as she phrased it, too different to care for the things it cared about, and so as he had decided to try Washington, where one was supposed to meet more varieties of people and of opinion. And on the whole, she should probably settle down in Washington, and make a home there for poor Medora, who had worn out the patience of all her other relations just at the time when she most needed looking after and protecting from matrimonial perils. "But Dr. Carver, aren't you afraid of Dr. Carver? I hear he's been staying with you at the Blenkers'." She smiled. H. The Carver danger is over. Dr. Carver is a very clever man. He wants a rich wife to finance his plans, and Medora is simply a good advertisement as a convert. A convert to what? To all sorts of new and crazy social schemes. But, do you know, they interest me more than the blind conformity to tradition, somebody else's tradition, that I see among our own friends. It seems stupid to have discovered America, only to make it into a copy of another country. She smiled across the table. Oh, you suppose Christopher Columbus would have taken all that trouble, just to go to the opera with the Selfridge Marys? Archer changed color. Andy Beaufort, do you say these things to Beaufort? He asked abruptly. I haven't seen him for a long time. But I used to, and he understands. Ah, it's what I've always told you. You don't like us. And you like Beaufort, because he's so unlike us. He looked about the bare room, and out at the bare beach, and the row of stark white village houses strung along the shore. Ear damnably dull. We've no character, no color, no variety. I wonder, he broke out, why you don't go back? Her eyes darkened, and he expected an indignant rejoinder. But she sat silent, as if thinking over what he had said, and he grew frightened lest she should answer, that she wondered to. At length she said, believe it's because of you. It was impossible to make the confession more dispassionately, or in a tone less encouraging to the vanity of the person addressed. Archer reddened to the temples, but dared not move or speak. It was as if her words had been some rare butterfly, that the least motion might drive off on startled wings, but that might gather a flock about it, if it were left undisturbed. At least, she continued, it was you who made me understand that under the dullness there are things so fine, and sensitive and delicate, that even those I most cared for in my other life look cheap in comparison. I don't know how to explain myself, she drew together her troubled brows, but it seems as if I'd never before understood with how much that is hard, and shabby and base the most exquisite pleasures may be paid. Exquisite pleasures, it's something to have had them, he felt like retorting, but the appeal in her eyes kept him silent. I want, she went on, to be perfectly honest with you and with myself. For a long time I've hoped this chance would come. That I might tell you how you've helped me, what you've made of me, Archer sat staring beneath frowning brows. He interrupted her with a laugh. Andy, what do you make out, that you've made of me? She paled a little. F you? Yes. For I'm of your making much more than you ever were of mine. I'm the man who married one woman, because another one told him to. Her paleness turned to a fugitive flush. Thought you promised you were not to say such things today. Ah, how like a woman. None of you will ever see a bad business through. She lowered her voice. Is it a bad business for me? He stood in the window, drumming against the raised sash, and feeling in every fiber the wistful tenderness with which as he had spoken her cousin's name. For that's the thing we've always got to think of, haven't we, by your own showing? She insisted. My own showing? He echoed, his blank eyes still on the sea. Or if not, she continued, pursuing her own thought with a painful application, if it's not worth while to have given up, to have missed things, so that others may be saved from disillusionment and misery, then everything I came home for, everything that made my other life seem by contrast so bare, and so poor, because no one there took account of them, all these things are a sham, or a dream, he turned around without moving from his place. And in that case there's no reason on earth why you shouldn't go back, he concluded for her. Her eyes were clinging to him desperately. H, is there no reason? Not if you stake your all on the success of my marriage. My marriage, he said savagely, isn't going to be a sight to keep you here. She made no answer, and he went on. Hat's the use? You gave me my first glimpse of a real life, and at the same moment you asked me to go on with a sham one. It's beyond human enduring, that's all. Oh, don't say that, when I'm enduring it. She burst out, her eyes filling. Her arms had dropped along the table, and she sat with her face abandoned to his gaze, as if in the recklessness of a desperate peril. The face exposed her as much as if it had been her whole person, with the soul behind it. Archer stood dumb, overwhelmed by what it suddenly told him. You two, oh, all this time, you two? For answer, she let the tears on her lids overflow and run slowly downward. Half the width of the room was still between them, and neither made any show of moving. Archer was conscious of a curious indifference to her bodily presence. He would hardly have been aware of it if one of the hands as he had flung out on the table had not drawn his gaze, as on the occasion when, in the little 20-3rd Street house, he had kept his eye on it in order not to look at her face. Now his imagination spun about the hand, as about the edge of a vortex, but still he made no effort to draw nearer. He had known the love that is fed on caresses and feeds them, but this passion that was closer than his bones was not to be superficially satisfied. His one terror was to do anything which might efface the sound and impression of her words, his one thought that he should never again feel quite alone. But after a moment the sense of waste and ruin overcame him. There they were, close together and safe and shut in, yet so chained to their separate destinies that they might as well have been half the world apart. What's the use when you will go back? He broke out, a great hopeless how on earth can I keep you? Crying out to her beneath his words. She sat motionless, with lowered lids. I shan't go yet. Not yet? Sometime, then? Sometime that you already foresee? At that she raised her clearest eyes. Promise you. Not as long as you hold out. Not as long as we can look straight at each other like this. He dropped into his chair. What her answer really said was, if you lift a finger you'll drive me back. Back to all the abominations you know of, and all the temptations you half guess. He understood it as clearly as if he had uttered the words, and the thought kept him anchored to his side of the table in a kind of moved and sacred submission. What a life for you! He groaned. Oh, as long as it's a part of yours. And mine a part of yours? She nodded. And that's to be all for either of us? Well, it is all, isn't it? At that he sprang up, forgetting everything but the sweetness of her face. She rose too, not as if to meet him, or to flee from him, but quietly, as though the worst of the task were done and as he had only to wait, so quietly that, as he came close, her outstretched hands acted not as a check, but as a guide to him. They fell into his, while her arms, extended but not rigid, kept him far enough off to let her surrendered face say the rest. They may have stood in that way for a long time, or Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.